Frédéric Chopin changed how we think about music forever when he composed his stunningly beautiful and nuanced pieces. And he did it on a horrible piano. In his book, Chopin's Piano, composer, conductor, and music historian Paul Kilday explores how Chopin, in his late 20s, used the only piano he could get his hands on while wintering on the island of Majorca to compose many of his beloved preludes. These short works, so sublime and so intimate, demonstrated how far the solo piano could take the listener. Kilday's story builds on mysteries, tragedy, international intrigue, even Nazis, as he explores the influence of Chopin's groundbreaking preludes and then traces the fascinating story of that clunky piano long after Chopin died. Paul, welcome.
Thank you. Lovely to be here, Rick.
What a fascinating book you have written. Now, there's lots of great and interesting and influential composers. What's special about Chopin and his piano that merited a book like this in your mind?
Well, I actually started from the end of the book and worked backwards in that I was originally interested in writing about what the fate of a lot of instruments in the Second World War because of the Nazi confiscation and looting of these very, very valuable instruments on a scale equal to the looting of art. Huh. And then when I started looking at this topic more closely, I ended up finding this one particular piano, and it's this piano that Chopin had with him in Majorca in 1838 and 1839, this terrible winter. And on this instrument, he wrote, you know, about 10 of the preludes and a lot of other very, very, very important works. And so I decided instead to take this one piano and trace it through 150 years or so and look at the fate of the instrument and also the fate of the music that was composed on it.
So why would the quality of a piano matter to a composer? Isn't he just using the piano as a tool to get the ideas in his beautiful brain down on paper?
Yeah, yes and no. It depends upon the composer. And in this instance, we know that Chopin wrote all of his works as a great improviser at the instrument. Like he'd have ideas on walks, etc., but he'd go home and he'd improvise. And then there's a long process where he turned these elaborate and rather wonderful improvisations into written works, which were then published, and the works that we know today. So the instrument on which he worked was integral to the pieces and how they turned out, which is why when he was in Majorca, he was waiting for this beautiful Pleyel instrument to come from Paris. But while he was waiting for this, he ended up using this instrument made by a local craftsman, Juan Bauza. And this is the instrument that he had for the majority of his time in Majorca and on which he wrote these fabulous pieces.
So your contention is that the preludes may have been composed differently had his Pleyel from Paris arrived in Majorca.
Oh, without doubt. And there are some wonderful examples that you can tweak out of the pieces themselves. Like if you look at number 7, which is this beautiful little music box waltz, it's almost as though Chopin was determined not to push the instrument beyond its capabilities. And there are other instances like the very famous Raindrop Prelude. The middle part of that is almost Chopin scratching away at the particular sonority of this instrument, which would have sounded very unstable on this rather primitive instrument. So yes, they would have, exactly as you say, they would have sounded very differently. This is the one that we actually know the most about because Georges Sand, who was Chopin's lover, wrote about this piano in her own letters and also in her memoir of the time on the island, where she writes and says that, you know, Chopin is composing on this local piano, which causes him more vexation than pleasure. But she writes about going down into Parma from Valdemossa, which is the lovely monastery in which Chopin and Sand were living throughout this winter, to try and effect the release of the Pleyel piano. There was a terrible rainstorm, and the trip that should have taken just a few hours ended up taking 7 hours. But when she came back, she saw Chopin at the Bauza piano playing a piece that she'd never heard before, and it was the Raindrops Prelude. Mm. And that's where she points out to him that the repeated note, it was exactly replicating the rhythm of the rain hitting the tiles in the monastery, which is where the piece got its nickname from. But yes, she wrote about this in some detail.
I just love that. When you travel, you visit the homes and the places where great musicians were inspired to write their music. And whether it's on a fjord with Edvard Grieg or wandering through Vienna with Beethoven or waking up in Salzburg with Mozart, you're saying that a composer like Chopin would be out in nature collecting ideas, working this out, and then he'd go home and like we would go to a desk to write, he would go to his piano to write. And he was sitting there frustrated because he was dealing with this makeshift temporary piano waiting for the good one to come in. on that piano, he wrote a collection of preludes that really changed music piano history in a lot of ways.
Well, they really did. Let's deal with the preludes themselves, which since Bach, you know, who had died almost 100 years before Chopin was in Majorca, no one really was writing preludes. And if they were, they were very primitive things. And here Chopin kind of looked back to Bach, but also looked forward to the works of Szymanowski and Debussy in the 20th century. So they're very unusual pieces in themselves. And then, as you say, he would have these ideas and these inspirations when he was walking. He was a very internal man. His life was lived very, very much inside his head, and then would come and work away at the piano. And then Sand also describes how this initial burst of inspiration would then take him days and days, often weeks, where he wrestled to try and get back the original inspiration and have it into shape on paper, you know, in the pieces that we know now.
We've entered the world of composer Frédéric Chopin on Travel with Rick Steves with Paul Kilday. Paul is a conductor and writer from Melbourne in Australia. For many years, he headed arts festivals and performance venues in England, and he's authored several books about composer Benjamin Britten. In Paul's historical narrative, Chopin's piano in search of the instrument that transformed music, even the pianos have stories to tell, as we learn what the composer had to endure to produce revolutionary music for the Romantic Age. Paul, when we think about music and travel, after all, this is a travel show, I love the way composers are inspired by their heritage, by their environment, by their loves. And when we think about Chopin, it's a big combination of that. When you go to Warsaw, you see a memorial to Chopin, the beloved composer of the country, even though he spent most of his career outside of Poland. And it's the willow tree blowing over his head in this big black statue. Have you been there and seen that statue?
Yes, indeed. Yes.
What I've heard is that it's when he was in Paris, he'll never forget the sound of the wind blowing through the willow trees in his homeland. And he kind of kept a bit of Poland with him.
And the interesting thing about Chopin is that not so much in his lifetime, but in the second half of the 19th century, different countries definitely wanted to claim him. So Russia and Poland wanted to claim him. Paris thought it should be able to claim him. Germany thought that it should be able to claim him because Germany was the custodian, if you like, of high art and the great romantic movement in music. And England also had
Does Majorca want him?
Majorca never kind of really knew what to do with him, not least because, of course, Georges Sand wrote a memoir of the time, you know, A Winter in Majorca, of their time there, which excoriates the locals and which was incredibly rude about the people that she encountered and the experiences that they had there. So Majorca for a long time felt very sensitive.
Of course, Majorca is a big Mediterranean party destination now. How was it in the middle of the 1800s or the early 1800s when Chopin went there? He would have taken a boat from Barcelona?
That's exactly right. He took a boat from Barcelona, and the journey took around 18, 19 hours. It was very primitive. It was a walled town, and so the walls that you can see there today completely contained the town as it existed. And of course, he stayed there for only a week or so and then moved outside the city of Parma and then later moved up the mountain to Valdemossa, which is this former monastery where they took a cell and were originally planning to stay there for a year. And the monastery itself is now incredibly popular. It has a big Chopin museum there. It has all these artifacts and letters and copies of manuscripts, etc. So that's rather beautiful. And you can catch a train which didn't exist in Chopin's time, of course, but this lovely Art Deco train up the hill from Parma to Soler. And it's very, very beautiful. And over these lovely aqueducts and through these little tunnels, it's actually very, very beautiful. But in Chopin's time, of course, far more primitive. And that's, of course, why there wasn't really an industry for concerts and for piano making, etc. So that's why Chopin ends up on this very primitive instrument.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Paul Kilday about his book, Chopin's Piano. It talks about the romantic music scene in the early 1800s. It also traces Chopin's piano after Chopin died. I mean, we're a third of the way through the book, Paul, and Chopin's dead, and the book carries on, and suddenly the main character is the piano itself. Where did Chopin's lousy Majorcan piano, the Bauza piano, travel? How could that be the what carries the whole story for you?
The piano remains in Majorca, in the cell in which Chopin and Sand lived, until 1911. And in 1911, the rather wonderful Polish harpsichordist Wanda Landowska was in Majorca giving concerts. because she was Polish, because she was a great grand pupil of Chopin, because she felt hugely the nationalist ownership, if you like, of Chopin. She travels up to Valdemosa, finds the piano there, and offers to buy it. And the owner refuses to sell it, but then 2 years later agrees. And so the piano is shipped to Landowska's place in Berlin, where it's photographed rather beautifully. And that's the photograph, actually, that's on the front cover of the book. There it remains until after the war, where Landowska takes a position in Paris. And so the piano moves with her to Paris. And then in 1926, she buys this rather wonderful little villa in the north of Paris, in Saint-Loup-la-Forêt. And it's there that she starts building up or adding to her collection of musical instruments. Mm. And the instruments are really quite well known because she uses them to teach, to write, to think about how music should be played, not least of all Chopin. And the piano remains there and is very well known as the Chopin piano. And Chopin, of course, was now this world figure. And so once the Nazis come to power in 1933, and then very particularly when they take over Paris in 1940, they start their looting of instruments in Paris and in France. And they make a note that they definitely want to get this Chopin piano as an important relic of great, you know, European culture.
Hmm. So, Paul, when we're traveling and when we love music, it's so much fun to stumble onto a site that relates to a composer that is important to you. In your travels, apart from Chopin, just composers in general, what are some fun and rewarding moments that you've had that people who are traveling might splice into their itineraries?
Well, I've been very privileged in that I've been able to play instruments owned by composers, and which aren't so easy to do. And that to me always seems an enormous privilege that you end up playing on a piano that Chopin had with him in England in 1848, for instance, or Benjamin Britten's really wonderful grand piano, or one of the harpsichords that von der Landowska owned and which is now in the Library of Congress in Washington. So I've been very lucky in that kind of practical level. I'm also very fond of the concert halls and recital places and archives that composers in particular have built. You know, you only have to think of Bayreuth as this monument to that great either composer or monster, Wagner, or the very, very beautiful concert hall that Benjamin Britten built in Snape in Suffolk in the UK. You can't help but be in there and feel that the spirits of these great men and women who have both built them and then performed there over a very long time are with you. So those are the things that I find more interesting just than tracing a particular itinerary that a composer or a performer may have followed himself or herself.
There is something to be said for letting the musical experience become even more sensual by being in the same spot or being in architecture that fits the music and so on. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Paul Kilday. His book is Chopin's Piano. And Paul, it is remarkable to think that on a godforsaken little corner of the Mediterranean. Of course, it's not godforsaken today because everybody loves it. It's a resort. But back then, it sounded like a pretty humble place, the island of Majorca. Chopin, he wished he had his better piano there, but on a ratty little local piano, composed a series of preludes that really had an impact on romantic music and music ever after. Talk a little bit about this accomplishment. He set out to write a prelude in each of the 24 possible keys, C, C-sharp, D, D-sharp, is that right?
That's exactly right, in the major and minor of each of those keys.
Why, for one thing, would you do that? Bach did it with the Well-Tempered Clavier, right?
Yeah, and Bach was a great idol of Chopin's, and the only score that Chopin had with him in Majorca, we know, was the 48 Preludes and Fugues. Hmm. And testimony from his pupils, Chopin's pupils, suggests that Bach was taught all the time in their lessons, that Chopin, whenever he was about to give a recital, would play the Bach Preludes and Fugues from memory. So they were all inside his head. And this was a way of making a homage, if you like, to Bach. And no one had done it on any significant scale since Bach. So Chopin was doing something that was looking back in a way that composers weren't yet looking back to Bach. So he was standing very much outside the romantic norms of his generation. And as I said before, also looking forward towards the music of Debussy, for instance, and other composers who would also think that a collection of preludes in all the keys was a wonderful exercise. But of course, in the 20th century, they were also not just tipping their cap to Bach, but they were tipping their cap by that stage to Chopin.
Paul, of the 24 Chopin preludes, the first one is one of the easiest, and it's also one of the most beautiful. How do you like number one?
Number one is, of course, an absolute tribute to the first prelude in Bach's 48. And so it's almost Chopin setting out his stall and just sort of saying, these are a tribute to, this great collection that came before me.
But Bach would not have had the opportunity to do rubato like you could do in the Romantic Age. Isn't that true?
That's certainly true. And of course, wasn't writing on a piano, was writing on a harpsichord.
So you didn't have the volume. You didn't have the dynamic contrast either.
No, absolutely. Huh. Dynamic contrast is one of the things that Chopin almost goes out of his way to establish in the preludes, partly because they're also fleeting. Some of them are only, 40 seconds long, and the longest one is only about 4.5 minutes. So he's setting to try and paint from the most enormous palette onto the largest possible canvas, even though, sometimes he's only got 40 seconds to do it.
These preludes, by their name, they were supposed to just be fun little amuse-bouches, but people are putting them all together and playing the whole thing as a collection that belongs together. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, it was André Gide who said, preludes to what? But that's not how Chopin thought. And he also didn't think of them as a collection of 24. That started happening late in the 19th century. He thought of them as just, little collections. So you might do four of them related by key, or you might do, two of them that are related by a particular interval or character. So it's not Chopin who said, we must perform these as 24. But now it would be very rare to hear them performed in any other way. You always hear them in the concert hall as a collection of 24.
And of course, today we're overwhelmed by an abundance of channels. And back then, they didn't have one channel. They didn't have any channels. It was gather around the parlor, light the candles, and let's listen to the piano player.
That's exactly right. And of course, Chopin emerged from that particular Parisian culture, the salon culture, where people did expect, wonderful, witty conversations, lovely wine. But then also, at some point, a composer like Chopin and a pianist like Chopin would sit down and play. And that would be the reward at the end of the evening.
A beautiful man who runs a little guest house in Warsaw recreates those salon evenings with a young pianist playing Chopin. And it's just gathering together, keeping it simple, being in the moment, and focusing on the music.
And that actually is the most beautiful idea as well, because we've moved so far away from the intimate settings where you feel as though you could just touch the music. That very, very intimate salon culture is something I enjoy finding myself when I travel.
Paul Kilday, you have inspired me to go home and work on my scales so I can play one of those preludes in one of the more difficult keys. Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
You'll find a link to Paul Kilday's book, Chopin's Piano, with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Let's close today's Travel with Rick Steves with an excerpt of Paul playing the actual Pleyel piano that Chopin himself performed on in England in 1848. It's on display with the Cobb Collection of Historical Keyboard Instruments at Hatchlands Park in Surrey. It's about 23 miles southwest of London. With thanks to our friends at the BBC Radio 4's Start the Week broadcast, here's a sample from Paul of Chopin's Prelude No. 13.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. There's more at ricksteves.com/radio.